Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Joey Barnes with Tribute Racing. Joined with me is Adam Tate of Tribute Racing, and we are presenting the In the Gravel Trap with Barnes and Tate. This is the first episode with just the two of us. And tonight, we're going to break down all the action from the IndyCar Series finale that saw Scott Dixon claim his fourth championship. We're also going to cover some of the latest safety innovations that have been developed in light of some of the tragic circumstances that have taken place at the IndyCar race at Pocono in the ABC Supply 500. We're also going to look at the world of F1. There's a lot of changes going on. You know, closed cockpits, are they the future of IndyCar and F1 machines? Or are we going to be looking at other solutions that go outside and go beyond canopies? And there's some teams making waves in F1 as well as manufacturers. And is Renault looking at potentially buying Lotus F1 team? And if so, will that keep Christian Horner at bay to stay with them, or will they look to advance to Mercedes? So we're going to be covering a lot of that tonight. There's a lot of stuff to get in depth on. And without further ado, Adam Tate, how are you doing tonight?
I am doing pretty well. How are you doing, Mr. Barnes?
Hanging in there, man. We've had a couple of wacky weeks of racing, and it's been a little bit since we've had a chance to get on the air with all these folks. So we're going to, I guess, start fresh. And the first thing we want to do is we haven't had a chance to acknowledge this without other than our writing. And if you go to TributeRacing.com, you can see all of the latest stuff that we put together there. But first and foremost, our thoughts with Justin Wilson's family. Definitely the tragic circumstances that we just referenced a few moments ago. Thoughts are with them. Hashtag Badass Wilson. If you get a chance, folks, go out and donate to the Wilson Children's Fund. And as well as you can, all the proceeds for shirts, decals, etc., 100% of the proceeds go to the Wilson Children's Fund. So donate. Go get the memorabilia, whichever you prefer. But by all means, try to help out if you can. And that leads us into the weekend and what we had as far as what was a ridiculous show in Sonoma. The Oriel Servia, the family chose him to replace Justin Wilson in the number 25 Andretti Autosport Honda. And they're very close friends. Justin Wilson's brother, Stefan, was here to help out as far as, like, being right there side-by-side with Oriel. And, you know, before we touch on Scott Dixon and the ramifications for what a crazy day in racing that was, I'd like to touch a little bit on Oriel Servia and, Adam, kind of what you thought as far as, you know, his run. At one point, he ran as high as third. A lot of that was due to strategy, but if the strategy had played into their favor, we could have very easily seen Oriel Servia finish in the top three instead of 12th. So, just what are your thoughts whenever you were looking at yesterday's race?
Thoughts on Servia were, my hat is off to him. I thought he drove remarkably well. As he said himself, the family requested it won, which I think is a huge testament to Oriel. And he had to answer that call. He drove magnificently. He came off the couch. He is not in fighting shape, as it were. And he drove very strongly, up to third at one point. And he could have really been up there had strategy fallen his way. That was the strategy that he, Marco Andretti, Sebastian Savager were kind of running, where they alternated from being at the front and being in the mid-pack at several points in yesterday's race. And it was really wonderful seeing him up there. I've always liked Servia. He's a great guy. He's a strong driver. And with that yesterday, you know, we had 39 drivers actually take part at least one round of the IndyCar season this year. And with just his one result, that actually put him, I'm looking at the standings right now, 32nd in the championship. By just one race, is one strong 12th place finish there, in addition to his 29th at Indy, because he usually does a one-off appearance at Indianapolis every year now. So Servia has still really got it. and I really admired what he was able to do. I know he had to be absolutely exhausted because the Indy cars are so physical to drive. They don't have power steering. Sonoma itself is so physical to drive. You've got blind corners. You've got massive elevation change. And that was a lot of laps out there yesterday. So my hat is completely off to Servia for what he was able to do, not just for Justin Wilson's memory and his legacy and his family and for Andretti Autosport, but what he was able to do for himself and to say that, hey, this guy is still a top-notch quality IndyCar driver.
Just briefly, what do you think they should do with that number 25 car now that the season's over? Do you think they should do you think they'll have it available for next year to maybe have somebody else in there? Because we know Honda really loved Justin and wanted him to be in that seat next year. Do you kind of feel like maybe we're looking at a different number but still a fourth full-time team over there at Andretti Autosport?
I think Andretti Autosport really needs a fourth full-time entry. They really struggled this year in comparison to the other big three teams, Penske and Ganassi, who are both full-time four-car entrants themselves. A lot of that had to do with Chevy versus Honda. But here, you know, in the latter part of the season, Andretti really came on strong, most notably Hunter Rey, who had a win and a second place to finish out the season, which is incredibly strong. So I think it merits a fourth entry for Andretti, and I think they really need it. Who they would go for and whether they'd use the number 25, I'm not sure. It might be kind of cool to see them abstain from using the 25, kind of how Formula One has retired the number 17 in honor of Jules Bianchi. But, you know, that remains to be seen if IndyCar is going to do that. But I think Andretti should definitely have that fourth car, whether they go for Simona, whether they go for somebody like Zach Veach they want to bring up from, you know, the junior leagues. But I think it would be a great thing to see.
Absolutely. All right. You know, touching on the race yesterday, kind of going more in depth with it, you know, Will Power had the pole and jumped out to a really nice lead there early. And all of a sudden, after we get through, I think the caution hit around lap 35 or so, or 45. The next thing you know, madness struck. We got Will Power trying to make a move on Joseph Newgarden, who ended up ultimately cutting off Juan. Will spun himself out. It damaged Juan's front wing. Juan came in as the points leader, and chaos and madness struck, and next thing you know, we've got a ton of different cautions, a ton of different strategies. When it was all said and done, Scott Dixon's the one that came out with it, with the lead, and he had to win with Juan placing sixth or worse, sure enough, or seventh or worse, I'm sorry, or was it sixth or worse? I think Juan ended up finishing sixth. He had to get the T5.
If Montoya finished sixth, they were going to be tied, and Dixon would win on a count back of wins.
So we've got all this going on, and Juan, with 12 laps to go, is 17th and drives up through the field. And, you know, he has the, I guess, fortunate circumstance of former F1 driver, camp car legend Sebastian Bourdais, who literally punted Graham Rahal out of his way when Juan was behind both of them and he needed to get by the three cars in front. And Graham obviously voiced his displeasure as TV caught after the race, saying a few expletives to Bourdais, which is very understandable. You're battling for a championship. Bourdais wasn't. You figure maybe there would be a little less crowding there. But all in all, you put this championship, this drive, because Dixon ultimately capped it off with the win. Juan couldn't get to Ryan Briscoe for fifth. He was right there about three car lengths back on the last lap. Do you put this more on Penske's faltering, or do you put this more on Scott Dixon and what this means to his legacy?
I put this more not so much on Penske's faltering, because things happen to everybody. No one is immune. But Scott Dixon seems to always have the wind at his back, always have the sun shining on his face, always puts himself in the position to take advantage, and he always seems to catch that lucky break. So it's really unfortunate for Juan. I think it would have been a much more exciting end to the race if he could have gotten that one more position and taken it. But you can't fault Scott Dixon. He's a four-time champ. He's the current leader in wins. He's fifth all-time in wins now. And he doesn't really show any sign of slowing down. The only thing I can fault him on is, the double point scenario, which is not his fault whatsoever. And Montoya benefited from double points in Indianapolis, but curiously enough, I saw a thing where someone went through and calculated what the points would have been if there were no double points races. And if Indianapolis and Sonoma had not been double points races, Montoya would have come out the champion, beating Dixon by only 4 points. There would have been a big gap back to Rahal, another decent gap back to Power, and then Castroneves and the Newgarden would have rounded out the top six. So once again, double points kind of mires the season ending championship battle, kind of like Formula One had last year, even though that ended up being beyond doubt Hamilton's title to have. But it's something worth looking at for IndyCar and IndyCar's future if they want to keep this. And if they want to keep things like bonus points for leading a lap, bonus points for leading the most lap, points for pole. I'd like to get your opinion on that. Do you think that's something that is good? It's unique to IndyCar, but is that the purest representation of who is best over a season?
I think, first and foremost, I have always disliked the double points rule. I didn't like it at the F1 championship last year. For a while, I wasn't really a big fan of ending the season on a road course. But if I've got to put some positives on a couple of things, the very few things that IndyCar has been doing right is this race yesterday was absolutely phenomenal from the standpoint of, like, me being the longtime fan that I am, not the average everyday viewer. I try to religiously watch everything and anything that has wheels. I really enjoy the strategic part of it. I really enjoy the fuel mileage, the tire management, everybody on different strategies, which we saw yesterday, and where you literally don't know what's going to happen until the checkered flag falls because of how everything plays out. That being said, I'm a firm believer that if you're going to have double points, and this is the only scenario that I'm ever okay with double point scenario, put double points on your crown jewel race, the series crown jewel. So for F1, Monaco. For Indy, obviously the Indy 500. And if you're NASCAR, the Daytona 500. NASCAR never touches double points. They leave it alone. They try to say no race is bigger than the other, more or less, but everybody knows Daytona is Daytona. Monaco, part of me wonders how it's so prestigious because every time I turn around, it's an uneventful race. But, it is what it is. Like, I think there's more fun watching Singapore, personally. But I think overall, if I was going to say double points would be okay in IndyCar, I think the Indy 500 is the one scenario where it should be rewarded. And I thought it very interesting that one, it led all the way from the start of the season to literally barely at the last race of the season when he dropped off. He would have been yet another guy who went on to win the Indy 500, won the championship, and I think that would have been really cool. But it would have definitely come full circle on his comeback. I'm not a fan of the fact that now we have all this momentum from such an amazing race. We as IndyCar, you grab this tragic circumstance that struck you a week ago, and you gave it its due. You made sure that everything was honored the appropriate way, just as media had done the same. And everything evolved, and we've got this spectacular show yesterday. And now what are we left with? We're left with next year. We're left with another 7 or 8 months of wondering, where the hell is the next race going to be? When is it going to be? Is it going to be March? Is it going to be April? Could it possibly be February, like is rumored? And, let's end it in October. This August mess, we have all the momentum gained from such an amazing show yesterday. And the crowds that I've seen in recent weeks, and in all honesty, it's ever since Auto Club and the franticness that was Pact Racing that was very scrutinized, that I am not... Is the racing great? Yes, but, you know, you got to listen to the drivers because you got to protect your assets, and at the end of the day, you got to keep them happy. But ever since then, you're running through Iowa, you have the race and the circumstances from last week, and it evolves into a championship battle that we had yesterday, which we saw at one point, with the exception of Elio, a lot of drivers were right around that championship lead at some point during the race. And mm-hmm. I just, where do these fans go now? I mean, they're left to look at F1, they're left to go to NASCAR because Indy just gave up on the rest of the season. Or on the rest of the year. So that's, if you wanted my opinion, there's the long-winded, in-depth answer on that one.
I couldn't agree more with you on the long-winded, in-depth answer, and that IndyCar really needs to extend its season. It's, in a way, it makes it easier to deal with the tragedy of losing Justin Wilson, that the season is ending. I think the only blessing are bright spot in the clouds that came after the tragedy of losing Dan in 2011 was that it was the season finale and everyone could go and be with their family as whenever wants to go and try and put it into perspective and grieve and heal and be ready to move on. And I think it's very much the same thing with Justin because it was very unexpected. It was very awful. But IndyCar definitely, and it's not just us saying it, it is the drivers, it's the teams, it's everyone else in the media, it's the fans. Everyone wants a longer IndyCar season. And I know Mark Miles is listening to that. And I know, or at least I hope with everything I have as a believer and lover of IndyCar, that they are taking that into account. But then you see other things like Derek Walker leaving. Gordon Kirby wrote an excellent article talking with Derek Walker on his 2 years in IndyCar. And how he is now leaving, in my opinion, very much a scapegoat for some of the issues they've had with the aero kits and some of the issues they've had this season with the balance between Honda and Chevy and parts flying off and people being injured. And there's a great thing that came out of that. I think one sentence that defines everything. And Walker said that, "I wanted to come in with a plan for the future, which is historically not something I've seen in North American open wheel racing." And I think that sums up any and every problem IndyCar has now or has had in the past, is that there's never a solid plan for the future. And you can't fix problems until you have that in place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree that there might be some level of him being a scapegoat. I think that that article, which, by the way, folks, if you get a chance, Gordon Kirby, is an amazing read, really goes in depth with some of the trials, the one-on-one with Derek Walker, some of the trials and tribulations that Walker faced during his time director of competition with IndyCar. For those that don't know, he stepped away after yesterday's race. He said at the end of the season, he was down, he was calling it quits. I think some of that is very telling, and to some extent, you got to wonder, it's not very common that IndyCar gets somebody like Walker, who was so infused, because he is a former owner in Champ Car and in CART and so on and so forth, that, you know, of course for him, there was the awakening of what it was like on the dark side, as he put it, you know, with race control and what have you. But you got to think that for somebody that's in IndyCar, when they have somebody like Walker come in, there's some sort of relationship that could be built to help form a bridge between the owners, and he could be the missing link, essentially. And now they're talking about Jay Fry and a couple of other people that are coming in. And I just, was Walker probably that savvy of a guy to be that guy? Probably not. Like as far as a director role, but I do think that there was some place for him to have a senior maybe consulting role or managing role within IndyCar. It does feel like he's forced out. It does feel like he's a scapegoat, and it's unfortunate. And I think that in some ways, that could be a good thing, not just for Walker, but also for the fans, because if IndyCar believes that Walker was the problem and he wasn't, we're about to find out real quick who the problem really was, because we're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500. We're coming up on a very milestone season in IndyCar racing, and as things progress, we're about to see what the problem really was, because if it wasn't Walker, it's going to come out soon enough, and that means it's going to get fixed, or at least I hope it gets fixed, but we'll all be able to recognize it. Some of us might think we recognize it already, won't name names, but I think some of the things that Walker did touch on to kind of move this forward in the direction that we were wanting it to go, not to get too sidetracked here, but is talking a little bit more about how they were spec racing. He was trying to move it away from spec racing, build a long-term vision, talk about 2018 cars. And, of course, there's, it could be 2019, 2020. There's a lot of things in that article that were covered. But as far as safety goes, to shift gears here, the thing from Pocono, there's a knee-jerk reaction. I know you've got a lot of ideas on this. A lot of it's because of your fascination with fighter planes and canopies, and there's been a lot of drawings that have gone on motorsport.com and racer.com. You and I have talked about it off the air several times. To you, after this incident,
yes.
What, as far as safety goes, without it's hard to cover every enhancement, but what are some of the key enhancements that maybe – you think IndyCar should be exploring now that we've kind of had a week or so to kind of digest everything, look at a lot of drawings, look at a lot of ideas. What's some of the things that stood out to you?
Some things that have stood out to me are some of the common sense things that were already being looked at. Interestingly enough, this also comes off the back of Jules Bianchi passing away recently. And a week before Wilson passed away, the FIA was looking at a study on some more driver protection, and there have been some illustrations put out by the Avid Design Mercedes has come up with that kind of has a extended roll hoop above the driver's head with a crossbar right in front of the driver that they could see on either side of. And I think it's hard to say the best thing to come out of this, but I wrote a really impassioned piece the night after Wilson's accident, before he even passed away, asking when is enough enough. And I feel like there's very much a general consensus among the motorsport community at large that it is enough and something does need to be done. And we're at the perfect time now with Formula One having extensive new regulations coming in 2017, IndyCar having a new car at 2018 at the earliest, and Barnhart and Miles have actually reached out to the FIA and said, we want to work with you in researching ideas for canopy protection, our increased windshields, something more to protect the driver. Other sensible things are being talked about, such as more tethers and parts of the cars that could break away, and more common sense design things. I love when Walker's done moving the sport away from spec racing by bringing in the aero kits, but it's just a little bit too much. It's too many pieces, as Joey, as you said so many times, too many variables. And there is finally, after abandoning it for a couple of decades, talk of bringing back more of a ground effect to the aerodynamics of top open-wheel race cars, be they IndyCar or Formula One. And by doing that, you can simplify, you can minimize the front and rear wings. You're not so aero-dependent on being in clean air. You can follow one another better. There are less pieces to break off. The cars can be stronger. They can be cheaper. They can race better with fewer incidents. So there's lots of good common sense talk. I don't think we'll see something going to full canopies, but there are lots of people putting out proposals. There's a company that builds a lot of canopies for drag racing, which does use them to great effect. They are one of the people who repaired the DW12s for the various IndyCar teams, and they said, hey, they're willing to start putting out designs and tests. And I really think in this coming off season, which we're already in for IndyCar and will be soon for Formula One, there'll be some extensive testing done, and that needs to continue throughout the next couple years and be integrated into these new designs from the get-go. So in 2017, 2018, 2020, we might see another one in a million accident, as it were, that Justin Wilson had or that Jules Bianchi had, and very well that driver might survive it then.
One thing that Ryan Hunter-Reay mentioned is something that F1 already does, and for the common fan, they may not get a chance to really notice this difference. It's very subtle to many people, but F1 drivers actually sit lower in the cockpit than IndyCar drivers. Very much it is a fighter-style kind of base where you are really submerged more into the cockpit itself. And, you know, with IndyCar, you're kind of raised up a little bit higher. And for somebody like Justin, you know, the guy's 6'4". A lot of racers aren't even 6 foot. So there was a big difference right there. And I think in situations when we're looking at things, that's an easy fix. I don't know necessarily, to kind of bring up some points of my own, I don't understand why we moved away from maybe just having a small windshield that was raised. Maybe they saw a long time ago there was no point in it. But if there was no problem with it, they just thought, oh, let's take it off. Well, then you just took off something that could have deflected some sort of energy that was coming towards the driver, whether it be debris or rubber or what have you. But I think the very simple things that come to mind for me outside of the canopy that you and I have touched on is, you know, you've got a nose there, and it was the nose piece, from what I understand, that caused the tragedy is, you know, it's 10 to 20 pounds. Why can't we tether that to the base of the cockpit, of the shell, so to speak? You know, certain parts can be tethered. And I think that when we're looking at that, that's something to explore. For a long time, we tethered wheels after the Adrian Fernandez accident in CART back at Michigan. I think that in doing away with these flicks and wicks and these rear bumper pods, which, if you know, everybody's wondering why these cars were catching air. If a car turns sideways and there's a wall, it's just like a stock car at Daytona or Talladega, you're going to have lift that creates, because you have a wall, the air has to go somewhere. It's usually going to go around and underneath. And I think that if we can lose these rear bumper pods, essentially you're looking at something that isn't necessarily such a giant wall, and it could just cut the air, because the air only has the rear tires and the rear end of the chassis to go through. I think, you know, the other element that you and I have touched on is outside of the canopies and the shells and this and that and the other is, what about the helmet? What can we do to help alleviate the stuff in the helmet, whether it's more ridges in the front that help kind of deflect the energy that hits the helmet? You know, we're looking at the NFL, who they limit concussions as much as they can by having Shute and Rawlings and everybody develop these helmets that are supposed to make everything safer. And I think when we're looking at that, you've got to think, okay, well, they drill holes in their helmets because they learned that drilling holes dissipated the energy. Maybe we can't necessarily do that because of heat and other variables, but there's some way that we can extract energy so that way whenever there is a blunt force that hits the helmet, that it doesn't necessarily do that kind of damage, that it doesn't absorb the energy. So I think there's a lot of different things going on, but I think all in all, just simplify the product. The racing, you know, we're looking at these flicks and wicks and all these little elements that deflect itself off the racetrack. And, you know, the old adage is, if it happens once, it's more than enough, because once is enough to do it. Well, last year we had James Hinchcliffe get hit with a piece of debris that fell off of a car at a road course. Gave him a concussion. I believe it was the Grand Prix of Indy, and he, for a while, was questionable as whether he can make the Indianapolis 500. Well, there was your one time. You didn't wise up. You didn't figure it out. And instead, we're going to add aero kits and all these elements this year. And I just think that the thing that I'm angry about is that I feel like it's something that could have been prevented, because we saw indications of this from the Hinchcliffe crash, or from the Hinchcliffe incident. And That's what makes me most angry about a situation like this. And at the time, there was no wreck in front of Hinch that caused that. It was simply debris that fell off of the car. I don't remember if it was a mirror piece or a winglet or what have you, but we know it was debris off of a car. So
exactly.
But anyway,
and that's the kind of thing that makes me angry about that as well. And it's now that it's being addressed, I'm happy. But we've had too many incidences. You went way back and mentioned people like D'Amata, but more recently there's been Hinch, who's okay. There was Felipe Massa, who was not okay for a while, but he's back and back to his best. But there are people who are no longer with us, like Henry Surtees and Dan and Jules and now Justin. And I think open wheel racing, one, got very comfortable the past decade and a half or so, and thinking that it had figured out most of its safety gremlins. But it also got very complacent due to that. And it got complacent in design. It kind of stagnated for a while. And I'm really excited to hear design changes coming, new ideas being put forth, or old ideas being resuscitated, you know, going forward with these 2017, 2018 plus plans. And if you look at older ground effect cars, they had big side pods because they had big Venturi tunnels under them to channel the air. If you look at current Indy cars, or if you look at current Formula One cars, the side pods are so minimal now. Sure, there's a lot of aero pieces tacked on in Indy car at the moment, but the side pods themselves have shrink-wrapped as tightly as possible around those engines. And if you just increase those side pods by putting a couple big tunnels to channel that air and to create that downforce without the use of big wings, you're going to have that much more side impact protection around the cars. You're going to have that much less of an area the teams are going to be having to develop throughout the season. It's going to cut costs. It's going to be more aero efficient. It's going to be more downforce. It's going to be less drag. It's going to be more side impact protection. It's going to be less pieces that can break off and fly through the air. So I think there's so many good ideas coming. And there are far too many intelligent, hardworking, passionate people who have the resources and by damn have the funding to make this happen the way accidents like this can, if not become a thing of the past, can become a lot rarer.
Do you think that to kind of side with the drivers here, and this is kind of where I feel about this, you feel like maybe we should be looking at the option of cutting the downforce down and maybe making the rear tires a little bit bigger? Because if you look at a situation where these drivers don't run flat out in the corners, then they have a little bit more control of the car. You know, Sage Karam was leading that race at Pocono. Not a rookie. At the end of the day, you know, Chip Ganassi feels that he's skilled enough to be in that race car, and he was leading at Pocono with, you know, 20 or 30 laps left when the incident happened. And he said, "I had a flat out, and it just came out. There was no indication, no warning, nothing different, didn't change his line or anything like that, and it just came out." And I feel like if we had increased downforce, or less downforce, but increased horsepower or more grip on the rear tires, yes, you go faster on the straightaways, but you actually have to throttle it back off in the corners. And I feel like that could really be something that's different, that could be so simple.
It is so simple, and this will make you feel good. You've got veteran designers like Gordon Murray and Adrian Newey and Gordon Bennett who agree with you on that. And you've got voices in the sport that are huge, like Will Buxton or Gordon Kirby, that agree with that as well. And I hope in drafting some of these new regulations and building these new cars that those voices are being heard. Because that's what the drivers want as well. The drivers don't want more downforce. They want more power and less downforce. Now, you can have a similar amount of downforce, but there's so many better ways, like ground effect, which I know I harp on a lot. There are better ways to create it than having these ridiculously complex surfaces that we have now that have absolutely no relevance outside of open wheel racing and no relevance in the greater R&D world, automotive world, or even in other motorsports. You've got all the flicks, all the flow conditioners, all the different panels sticking out of IndyCars that you loathe. And then if you go look at F1, they have less, but they still have some, but they have like a 37L in the front wing, which is masterful at creating downforce and conditioning the flow around the rest of an open-wheel race car, but is terrible for overtaking. It's ridiculously expensive, and if enough pieces on it break, can be dangerous, one, and two, ruin the driver's race. You know, I want to see cars that are a little bit more robust, where these guys can bang wheels a little bit more, and, you know, you don't lose some part off your wing and have your whole race ruined, or have a piece off your wing fly off, hit some guy in the head, knock him unconscious, make him miss a couple races, or even worse. You know, there's a better way to do this.
Oh, man. Well, we're going to... going to be more to explore. There's, obviously, this is a very sensitive subject. We could go, this is an entire show if we wanted it to be, but
easily.
We'll see what comes up as the off season for IndyCar is now here, and as we creep more into the season, I'm sure we're going to get more as far as evolution and testing and different things that we can bring to the table. Moving on to the F1 scene, there's been some things that we haven't had a chance to touch on with everybody here lately, and, you know, some silly season moves as well as Renault and a whole lot of craziness as far as the paddock goes. And we're getting ready to creep up here on Monza at the end of this week, and, you know, it is with some very, sensitive, it's a sensitive topic for you and I, because this could very easily be the last Monza we see for some time if F1 can't get a deal done. And I think that if we can't have Monza, first off, it's going to piss me off. But, you know, I think it's going to piss off the average fan. And I don't think that it's smart to, under any circumstances, lose Monza because of the fan base that exists there. Because Ferrari is your big wig team. That it is the most historic, the most premier team, the most coveted. And when you go there, it's like a religious cult. It is. Fans are everywhere, and there's a sea of red all around that track, and I feel like if we lose Monza, there's a piece of F1 that's lost as well.
Oh, yeah. Monza, you could say, is the beating heart of Formula One. Spa is everybody's favorite circuit. Monaco is the most glamorous. Silverstone, where the first official Grand Prix was, and the modern-day Formula One championship, but Monza is the heart and soul, just as Ferrari is the heart and soul of Formula One. And I think it's absolutely asinine that Bernie says we have to have the same deal with them as we do with everyone else. And he's treading some really thin water if he thinks that Formula One can turn its back on a track that is so huge in its history and so much a part of its heritage and tradition and walk away from that. I don't think they will, but the fact that it's become this much of an issue, that it's a possibility that we are talking about it, that the rest of the media is talking about it, that fans are worried about it, to me is ridiculous.
Do you think that maybe the reason it is being talked about is not because it's Monza or this or that, because everybody knows the contract's up at the end of this year and they've got to renew, but do you think maybe something that nobody has talked about is that a lot of people look at San Marino, Imola. Do you think that maybe there's maybe another wild card in the mix, that maybe there's a hand that Bernie isn't playing, a circuit that nobody's talking about, that has kind of creeped up into the conversation to potentially replace Monza?
You know, that is a very Bernie thing to do, is the left hand distracts you so you don't see what the right hand is doing. And he is brilliant at that. He's used that to build Formula One into what it is today, and he deserves massive props and a lot of credit for it. At the same time, I hope not in this case. I love Imola. I love the San Marino Grand Prix. I don't think it should have ever been taken off the calendar. It's a fantastic track. There's a lot of history there. Some of it is sad, going back to Senna in 94, but so much of it is brilliant and wonderful. And if we can have multiple Formula One races in other places, as we sometimes do, I think Italy could easily have Monza and San Marino. But should the worst happen and Monza be dropped from the calendar, having Imola be there would be some measure of, I guess, consolation for me at least.
I can slightly agree. I don't know. not having a race in Italy, I mean, Toro Rosso and Ferrari are based there. I think, you know, there's Sauber gets their engines from Ferrari. That's more or less kind of a home field thing for them as well. Shifting gears for a second, which I'm saying shifting gears religiously a lot tonight, and I just said religiously for the second time. So, looking at the entire season as a whole, silly season coming around, everybody was looking at Valtteri Bottas to take that Ferrari seat from Kimi Raikkonen. They thought that Kimi would be opted out. They wouldn't pick up his option for 2016. Ferrari wouldn't. And all of a sudden, bam, Maurizio Arrivabene decided to go ahead and put Vettel and Kimi alongside each other for the second season in a row for 2016. And it's the first time since 2013 that Ferrari has brought back the same drivers. Back then it was Fernando Alonso and Felipe Massa. And now we've got Kimi back for one more year. Ferrari is starting to really develop and find itself, and I don't know if they're just giving him the R&D car, because that guy's ran into trouble at every single venue. The only race that he never had an ounce of trouble at was at Bahrain. And at Bahrain, he finished a second. If there's another lap, he's going to win the damn thing. And, you know, you give him the car, he still proves the drive, even though it's a V6. He has no wins in the V6 turbo era. Which I think is very interesting to highlight. I personally thought Ferrari would have a better showing at Spa. This being said, do you think that it is, you've got the Haas Formula seat, you got supposedly Valtteri Bottas has got one more year left at Williams, Felipe Massa's over there, McLaren's making some waves, Sauber's confirmed their lineup's going to remain the same, Force India, you know, a lot of moving parts here. Silly season is by far from over, just because the biggest piece of the puzzle, Kimi Raikkonen, has been taken care of, doesn't mean that we couldn't have some other movers.
Very true. And I think it was smart to have some continuity at Ferrari. It's a place that has undergone so much change. Massa leaving, Kimi returning, Alonso leaving, Mariachi barely being there, Montezemolo leaving, now Arrivabene coming in, and Arrivabene has gone on record, and he said that this is the team I want. This is the team I was hoping to build up when I got here at the start of the season. So to say that speaks volumes. I think Arrivabene is a brilliant team principal. If you do what he's done, some of the credit does have to go back to Mariachi and Montezemolo and some of the people who were there before he was. But with him at the helm, with James Allison building the cars, with Kimi and Seb having such a strong relationship, where Seb can lead the way, but if he falters, Kimi is more than capable of winning races and championships, as he's shown. I think it was smart to give him another chance. And it really doesn't knock the silly season out of whack. Now what we're starting to see is all these other teams going, oh, we want to retain our guys, we want to retain our guys. Red Bull wants to keep Kvyat and Ricciardo. They're going to keep them. Force India is really pushing to keep Hülkenberg and Perez, as they should. Even though Hülkenberg keeps being mentioned with Haas, I think he's out of reach for him. I don't see why Hulk would leave a, you know, front of the midfield pack team for such an unknown as Haas. You've got Sauber already going and keeping their guys. It looks like Bottas will stay place with Williams alongside Massa, so there's stability there. I don't see a lot of changes, but it doesn't mean it won't happen, and especially for 2017, you've got Ferrari looking at Verstappen, you've got Magnussen maybe leaving McLaren, you've got Van Dorn maybe leaving, his button staying. You never know what Alonso's going to do. Is Bottas then going to leave? Does Ferrari have no interest in him anymore? They have one fan. Do they want to replace one Finn with another? The only time that's really been successful is when Raikkonen took over Hakkinen back in glory days of McLaren Mercedes over a good decade ago. So there's a lot of things afoot